example that you generated.
I see. When does Zakat al-Fitr become due, Sheikh?
Well, I would say that once the appearance of the moon. You know, here I should make a mention of the controversy, or there's a kind of actually a difference of opinion when it comes to when one can pay Zakat al-Fitr. Now, there are some scholars who are of the view that Zakat al-Fitr can be given any time during Ramadan, whether it is before the 15th of Ramadan, in the early days of Ramadan, or after the near the end of the Ramadan. So there are some scholars like His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sistani who is of the view that it can be paid any time during Ramadan. But, of course, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that the Zakat al-Fitr cannot be paid any time during Ramadan. It must be set aside on the eve of Eid al-Fitr. So it can be given after it is set aside. So after, for example, he is of the view that once the appearance of the new moon of the month of Shawwal has been ascertained on the night preceding Eid al-Fitr, then one may set aside the amount of goods or money one must pay as Zakat al-Fitr. And of course, if one is planning to attend the Eid al-Fitr prayer, one must, as a measure of obligatory precaution, submit the amount due, or at least set aside prior to the to performing the prayer.
Okay, I see.
Put it aside. Maybe you cannot find within those 2 hours any poor person, so you can set it aside and make sure that money that you set aside will not be used by you yourself. That same very money that you have put aside must be kept for the poor person. For example, if it's old or new, you cannot replace it with new ones or with new notes, with new bills.
I see.
And that same bill must be paid to the poor.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take another break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the Zakat al-Fitr, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javed, presuming there are people in another country who are more in need than those in our own country or the country of our residence, is it permissible to pay Zakat al-Fitr a few days early so that it may reach the recipients in the foreign country on time? Also, can we ask someone else or who lives in that particular country to pay Zakat al-Fitr to the qualified recipient on our behalf and then reimburse him later when we meet?
Right, that's a good question. Of course, as I said, that as a measure of obligatory precaution, you cannot pay the Zakat al-Fitr in advance. For example, if you just make a phone call to your friend and tell him to pay Zakat al-Fitr any time during Ramadan, that's not valid as a measure of mandatory precaution, ihtiyat wajib. But of course, it is permissible to ask someone to function as your representative, wakil, in paying Zakat al-Fitr to the poor people on your behalf on the same time day of Eid al-Fitr. For example, in the morning of Eid al-Fitr, someone who represents you, will function as an agent, as a representative, and will give the money on behalf of you to the poor person in another city or another country. And that's a good mechanism. And so you will reimburse him later on after you meet him, or maybe somehow you will send him the money. But that person in another country or in another town will function as your agent or representative and will give the poor people the zakat al-fitr on your behalf and also on behalf of your kids or your wife, your children. And of course, as I said, it is permissible to grant the amount that one will have to pay as zakat al-fitr to a qualified recipient during the month of Ramadan as a loan. That's another solution, okay? You give some money as a loan to someone, and then when the beginning of the month of Shawwal has been ascertained, one can forfeit the loan as payment for zakat al-fitr. Okay, you will consider that amount you lent to someone as qazul hasana, you will consider that as zakat al-fitr, and you will not demand it later on.
A very quick question, Sheikh. We don't have much time. What if he forgot zakat al-fitr or to pay it?
Well, if you have set aside the amount prior to noontime on Eid al-Fitr, but have forgotten to pay it due to some reasons, you need only to submit the amount you have set aside, okay? And of course, but if you have not even set aside the amount due on you, of course, you must, as a measure of obligatory precaution, pay your zakat al-fitr to the qualified recipient. Qualified recipient means a poor and eligible person. But your intention in doing so should simply be to seek proximity to God, qurbatan ilallah, without distinguishing it as a timely action, ada, or an overdue action whose time has passed.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. And thank you, my listeners, my audience, for joining your own program, Islamic Laws. We've been talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to zakat al-fitr based on a fatwa issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Black and white. Hablar del Líbano.
Discussing Lebanon means delving into a hub of conflicts where various positions clash.
Conviven y luchan entre sí las posiciones que hablan de
advocating for national liberation and social justice against those promoting subjugation and colonialism.
El Líbano contemporáneo es un país aún.
Contemporary Lebanon still faces challenges related to decolonization, with the lingering influence of French and even American imperialism. This is just one aspect of Lebanon.
Esa es una parte del Líbano. Pero
on the other hand, there are those who strive for sovereignty and independence, standing in solidarity with their Palestinian brothers. This represents the resistance of Lebanon, comprising democratic and popular forces from various parties.
Uno de ellos, el más destacado,
Among them, Hezbollah stands out, having played a heroic role in sacrificing many of its founding leaders.
Los mejores líderes, los líderes fundadores en esa resistencia.
In the fight against the Zionist occupiers.
El Líbano vive en una situación.
Lebanon finds itself in a very complex economic situation, with 44% of its population living below the poverty line. And in some rural areas, this figure rises to 62%. The country faces ongoing destruction from bombings carried out by the Zionist entity.
Bombardeos que significa destrucción de viviendas,
which devastated homes, schools, hospitals, churches, universities, workplaces, and even agricultural lands.
Industria, inclusive plantaciones.
Despite these challenges, Lebanon continues to exist and embodies the spirit of solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Ser solidario con el pueblo palestino. Incluso.
Following the resistance action on October 7, 2023, Lebanon, through Hezbollah, opened a second front the very next day, October 8, to alleviate the pressure of the attacks on Gaza and draw some of that focus towards itself. This act demonstrates a profound sense of solidarity, signaling that Lebanon stands with Palestine.
Claro, el Líbano.
Lebanon gained its independence in 1943, and by 1946, French troops had withdrawn.
De cualquier manera,
However, the Nakba in 1948 led to the displacement of nearly a million Palestinians. Many sought refuge in Lebanon, and the political and social landscape of the country has been significantly shaped by the presence of the Palestinian people, leading to an immediate expression of solidarity. Lebanon finds itself in a complex situation, caught between factions that still aspire to serve imperial interests, primarily those of France, and by extension the United States and pro-Zionist agendas. On the other hand, there is a significant and healthier segment of the population that's striving for national liberation, while also standing in solidarity with the broader liberation movements in Western Asia, especially the Palestinian people. We are confident that this small nation will discover its path and will consistently be a strong and united force in the resistance. The political parties aligned with this vision are likely to assert their perspectives, as the people demand it. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Huartes.
Soy Eduardo Huartes. La prensa hegemónica occidental.
Western mainstream media often portrays Lebanon as an oasis of European civilization that's been lost.
De civilización europea que se habría perdido.
It seems to have fallen under a sort of curse, straying from its promise of Western democracy and a French lifestyle. The reality is that contemporary Lebanon, since its independence in 1943, or rather limited independence, has stood in solidarity with Palestine. It has faced numerous aggressions from the Zionist occupiers of Palestinian land.
Independencia, una independencia que todavía es mezquina.
The Zionist occupiers have also faced their share of defeats in this confrontation. Lebanon is a country of both light and shadow. To discuss Lebanon today, its people, organizations, and resistance, we have Alex and Franz with us. He is a Catalan national currently in Casablanca, working as an independent researcher and journalist, as well as an educator and political analyst for various international media outlets.
En varios medios de comunicación internacionales. Es coautor.
He's also a co-author of the documentary Palestine, The Murder Truth, Voices for Peace.
Bienvenido, Alex.
Alex and Franz, welcome to Black and White.
Negro y Blanco.
Hello, Eduardo. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Alex, ¿cómo podemos definir?
It's a pleasure. Alex, how can we characterize contemporary Lebanon, considering its social and political contradictions, along with the imperialist interference, primarily from France and still from the United States, in education and various other sectors, right? In that context, how is it possible for resistance and solidarity with the Palestinian people to take root, grow, and thrive? Well, Lebanon has a unique history. If we consider the insights of one of the prominent contemporary intellectuals, George Korn, who recently passed away, we can see how he examined Lebanon's diverse identity, particularly in relation to its mountainous regions and cities. Historically, Lebanon's population is made up of various communities, often referred to as confessional groups, and this confessionalism was indeed reinforced by foreign presence. The history of Lebanon dates back to the Ottoman Empire, when it was recognized as an autonomous entity. Following the dismantling of the Ottoman Empire, France took control of the region. French colonialism capitalized on the existing communitarianism and the various religious communities present. This dynamic has significantly contributed to the tensions experienced in Lebanon since its independence. The Civil War period is well known, and while it cannot be solely attributed to religious war, the vision of progressive or reactionary society was based on the existence of these religious communities, according to their own interests. It's important to note that foreign powers have been heavily involved in Lebanon, manipulating these interests for their own benefit. However, Lebanese nationalism exists beyond communal or religious affiliations, and this national identity is inextricably linked to the fate of the Palestinian people. It's crucial to address the issue of solidarity with the Palestinian people. Since the establishment of a Zionist regime in the region, over 700,000 Palestinian refugees were displaced, with more than 100,000 finding refuge in Lebanese society. This historical context significantly influences recent events, making the resistance against ongoing Zionist aggression towards the Lebanese people an essential aspect to consider. Yes, it's quite striking that the artificial creation of this entity known as the regime of Israel occurred so rapidly. Lebanon adopted a generally hostile stance, which is a significant aspect of its history. In 1948, Lebanon quickly aligned itself with the Palestinians, welcoming them and supporting their cause, which also led to the development of resistance. What influence, dear Alex, do you think the presence of Palestinians has had on shaping the current identity and mindset of Lebanon?
I would say that the rights of the Palestinian people are an integral part of Arab identity. This does not mean that there aren't national realities or distinct identities for each country. Otherwise, we would fall into the trap of the arguments made by Zionism and imperialism, which aim to erase individual identity. From the very beginning, Zionism sought to eliminate Palestinian identity, viewing them merely as Arabs who should be expelled to neighboring countries. However, Palestinian national identity is rooted in its own history and struggles. It's also important to remember that the Lebanese people have been affected since the inception of the Zionist project, particularly with the massacre at Hula, which marked the beginning of aggression. This cannot be erased from our collective memory.
Alex,
we're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Estamos de vuelta con Alex Anfrons.
We're back with Alex Anfrons. Alex, you were explaining to us the importance of distinguishing the nationality of the Palestinian nation as such, as well as the nationality of the Lebanese nation. You were delving a bit deeper into that. Please continue.
Estaba profundizando un poco eso. Adelante.
Me parece importante tener en cuenta que, bueno, en la conformación de...
It's important to recognize that various factors contribute to the formation of a nation, but the feeling of belonging to that nation is something that cannot be erased by force. The Palestinian identity is very much alive. I have had the opportunity to witness this firsthand during my visit to the West Bank on several occasions. This national identity transcends religious beliefs and encompasses a vision for society, fostering dialogue that allows for future aspirations. In Lebanon, we witnessed the fourth military aggression, marking a historical pattern of invasions and a series of massacres against the Lebanese civilian population. The 2006 war was a significant Zionist aggression prior to the current situation, which ultimately ended in a defeat for the Zionist army. Hezbollah, recognized as the Islamic resistance of the Shia faith, made a significant mark as the only Arab military force capable of historically defeating that criminal army. The aim was to eliminate this example, but it's crucial to remember that within the doctrine of the Zionist army, the Dahiya doctrine, it was approved in 2006, named after a neighborhood in Beirut. This doctrine indicated that the civilian casualties in Lebanon or any other country were of little concern, meaning that attacks on civilian populations were not to be considered. This clearly aligns with the concept of indiscriminate attacks on civilians, which has also been evident in the ongoing offensive in Gaza for over a year, a situation that many international observers have already labeled as genocide.
Por muchos observadores internacionales ha sido ya caracterizado como un genocidio.
Así es, pero el genocidio ha sido de tal naturaleza.
Absolutely. The genocide has been of such a nature that it has profoundly affected the world, and this is crucial to recognize. Well, here is the question. How have the events in Syria influenced the capabilities of resistance groups, particularly Hezbollah and other Lebanese resistance forces, in terms of Lebanon's sovereignty and support for the Palestinian nation? How do you see the impact of the new situation in Syria? How does this situation appear in Western Asia?
Se ve eso en Asia Occidental.
Hay dos lecturas de la situación. Una basada en...
There are two perspectives on the situation. One can be described as a geographical viewpoint, focusing on the balance of power and international forces vying for control over territories and various strategic projects. The other perspective, which I favor, centers on the experiences of the people. Considering in Syria, it clearly represents a setback for the alliances and support that Syria has provided as part of what is seen as a resistance axis. This axis, as I explained, emerged and strengthened following the 2006 defeat and Hezbollah's subsequent victory. However, it's important to note that Hezbollah is not the only historical actor that has opposed the actions of the criminal Zionist army. For this reason, I emphasize the importance of recognizing that Hezbollah's formation dates back to 1982. History does not solely revolve around the geopolitical viewpoints of major powers, even if this situation leads to a reduction in support, particularly in terms of weaponry or infrastructure, it does not signify the end of resistance. The Lebanese people have shown resilience even before Hezbollah was established. They have consistently asserted their sovereignty and independence against both Zionist invasions and various regional actors that have interfered in their country's politics. It's important to recognize that Lebanon is currently facing one of the highest debt levels in the world. The nation has been devastated on multiple fronts economically, largely due to the influence of international players since the early 1990s. Despite this fragile situation, the Lebanese people have continued to resist, and that resistance is far from over. This is a struggle of the people, manifesting in various contexts and conflicts throughout history. It would be a mistake to underestimate the impact of NATO's Western offensive in the region, which poses a challenge to what could be seen as an alliance supporting the defense of both the Palestinian and Lebanese peoples. Nonetheless, this resistance will persist in one form or another.
palestino, del pueblo libanés, pero esa resistencia va a continuar de una o de otra forma.
Así es. Mira, el actual secretario general de Hezbollah.
The Secretary General of Hezbollah has urged the Lebanese state and its army to act courageously in confronting what he describes as Zionist aggression.
Y asuma como tal el enfrentar, digamos, a...
This situation may benefit the more reactionary sectors, or perhaps Hezbollah's call will have a stronger impact in rallying Lebanese national unity against the Zionist entity. What are your thoughts on this contradiction at this time?
La entidad sionista. ¿Qué opinas tú sobre esa contradicción en este momento?
Bueno, en primer lugar, una cosa importante destacar es que...
First of all, it's important to highlight that Hezbollah, as a resistance movement, has strengthened its position within the fragile Lebanese political system. This system has been affected by various actors, particularly Saudi Arabia, which has played a significant role in Lebanon's economic politics alongside figures like Rafik Hariri. Their involvement in issues such as debt and privatization has led to a severely deteriorated economic situation with over 80% of the population living in poverty. Additionally, the current crisis has resulted in nearly a million internally displaced persons due to the ongoing war. The arrival of Syrian refugees adds another layer to the situation. It's essential to recognize that despite everything happening, Hezbollah serves as a catalyst for a national resistance of the Lebanese people. Contrary to the label of terrorist often used in Western and Zionist propaganda, it represents a nationalist struggle. While there are other progressive and resistance forces, the Lebanese army and the state currently lack trustworthiness. Over the past years, we've seen that there isn't a truly functioning Lebanese government, leading to a state of significant fragility. Nevertheless, the popular support for the resistance is a crucial factor. This support is often targeted by propaganda, which attempts to justify attacks on civilians by claiming that weapons are hidden among them, a claim that is simply untrue. The Israeli army has targeted over 50 hospitals and has bombed essential water resources, distribution centers, primary care facilities and schools. Attacks on civilian infrastructure cannot be justified in any way. This reflects the strategy of a criminal army attempting to punish the civilian population, fully aware that this resistance movement has support among the people.
Absolutely, Alex. Israel must withdraw from this country's south by the January 26th deadline. However, the Zionist entity has completely disregarded, continuing with numerous atrocities. We really appreciate you being with us on this program here on Black and White. Thank you so much.
Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much to you.
Thank you.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir. iranradio.ir.
IRIB English Radio presents The Month of Allah. Let's be with Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
As I look to nature's beauty, dazzled am I, knowing everything calls on you, the Lord Most High.
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, Wassalatu Wassalam ala Ashrafil Anbiya'i wal Mursaleen, Sayyidina Abul Qasim al Mustafa Muhammad. The month of Allah is the month that we are developing our connection to God. In this month, when we enjoy the different du'as that we read, the different salats that we do, the different prayers that we do, when we read the Holy Qur'an, we have an enjoyment that we didn't have during the other months. Now, this connection to God, we were talking about how it gives us life. It gives us the true essence of human life. According to Aristotelian logic, humans were defined as haywanun natiqun, animals that could speak, animals that would think, and their speech comes from their ability to think. But one of our philosophers and one of the mufassirs and commentators of the Holy Quran said that this is problematic, that human beings should be defined as this, hayyun muta'allihun, that human beings, once they're created, they will live eternally. There's a hereafter for them. And that second of all, the differentia is that humans are muta'allih, they are connected to God. Therefore, for a person to be a true human being in the eyes of religion, it is a human being that is connected to God. And we see this in the traditions. We see that if we were to obey God, God would give us some of the same powers that He has. In some of these traditions, it says, Abdi ati'ni, my servant, follow me, obey me, أَجْعَلُكَ مَثَلِي or مِثْلِي, and I will make you similar to me, I will make you like me, meaning that the same powers that God has, with His permission, He will give it to the humans. Meaning that mankind, when he becomes close to God, when he becomes alive, and he reaches the different stages of being alive, at the end, he will become similar to God. He will have the powers of God. So why should we limit ourselves? Why should we only limit ourselves to a material form of being? If human beings have such a potential, isn't it not right for us to limit ourselves to a very low form of life, a very low form of hayat? When we look at other traditions, we read, أَتِعْنِ فِيمَا أَمَرْتُكْ أَجْعَلُكَ تَقُولُ لَشَيْءٍ كُمْ فَيَكُونَ, follow me in what I have commanded for you, and I will make you say, be and it is. This is one of the verses of the Holy Quran, be and it is. Allah commands something and it is. So human beings have this potential to reach a very high level of power, even though we're not searching for this power, but this is showing you the potential of humans. Another thing that when you think of life and this connection, it brings for us absolute joy. How many of us complain that we are not enjoying ourselves? We're not having, you know, a good life in this world. We've seen many of the prophets, many of the scholars, that when they have connected to God, once they have true life, no matter what troubles and tribulations life might bring them, they are still very happy people. Why? Because they have the greatest form of enjoyment. They say once you reach this form of enjoyment, which is lizzat, which is this connection to God, which is this enjoyment, they cannot compare this to anything. For example, in the traditions, we say from Imam Ali alayhi salam, in atyab shay'in fil jannah wa ladhahu hubbullah. What is the most beloved thing in heaven? What is the greatest joy in the hereafter? The narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam says, loving God and what? Wa hubbu fillah. Wal hubbu fillah, meaning that loving in the way of God, loving those that God loves, loving Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, loving his family. These two things are the most important enjoyments in the hereafter. The hereafter is the world, is the realm where the realities of things are open for us. So if live that true enjoyment, it's connecting to them, loving Allah and loving his prophets and loving their successors. We understand that also in this world there is this love, there's this enjoyment. And many of us have felt this during the nights that they have cried for the Prophet, cried for his progeny, and they have connected to them. They feel a great, immense sense of love and joy for them. And then if you ask them, can you change this? Would you exchange this for anything that you have in this world? They'll say, no, we would not. So for us, inshallah, in the remaining days and nights of the month of Ramadan, we want to enjoy life. And we understand that this is a critical part in the definition of human beings. And then this is the way for us to truly enjoy our life and for us to overcome all the calamities and tribulations and problems that we might face. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ahla baytihi tayyibin tahirin.
قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله إن أعجز الناس من عجز عن الدعاء.
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله said, verily, the weakest person is the one who is incapable of supplicating.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله ما لنا رب سوى
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله ما لنا رب سوى.
South Africa's iconic freedom fighter and first democratically elected leader Nelson Mandela once remarked, "We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians." So how can the International Quds Day be utilized as a strategic platform to further Mandela's vision of a free Palestine and work towards realizing his dream? And to discuss the International Quds Day and Africa's support for the liberation of Palestine, we are joined by Dr. Firuz Osman. He is the executive member of Media Review Network. We are also joined by Hassan Loggett. He is the co-founder of Media Justice Africa. The International Quds Day is observed annually on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. Established by Imam Khomeini in 1979, this popular occasion serves as a global expression of solidarity with the Palestinian people in their struggle against the Israeli apartheid regime and its ongoing atrocities. Quds Day has united voices worldwide in support of Palestine, and today, Africa has emerged as a formidable resistance force against the Israeli genocidal regime. Despite intense U.S. pressure and Israeli attempts to infiltrate the continent, Africa's resistance continues to strengthen. Countries like South Africa, drawing from their own anti-apartheid struggle, are at the forefront of resisting the Israeli apartheid regime. South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice further cements Africa's role as a leading advocate for Palestinian liberation. Africa is proving that solidarity with Palestine is more than symbolic. It is a firm commitment to dismantling the Israeli apartheid regime. So how can the International Court's Day be utilized as a powerful platform to advance Nelson Mandela's vision of a free Palestine and turn his call for justice into meaningful action on the global stage?
Africa backs God's liberation.
Each year on the International Coup's Day, large-scale demonstrations take place across Africa in support of Palestine, home to one-third of the global Muslim population. The continent sees hundreds of thousands joining the worldwide movement advocating for Palestine's liberation. A participant at one of the demonstrations held in the coastal city of Mombasa in Kenya speaks here on the importance of standing with the oppressed people of Palestine.
We should not be ashamed to stand with the oppressors if our hearts are burning, but we keep away from the people who are oppressed. We can't even raise the voices. Then shame on us. We have one thing left on us, and that's our voice. And if we come out, we should claim this occupation no more and not say Israel is a free state, but Israel is a no state, because it was a usurped land of the Palestinians, given by the British. The Balfour Declaration gave them land that doesn't belong to them. Why? Because they wanted to get rid of the Jews that were there. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to me, but please, I would request you, echo this out. Remind the people of the world that the oppressed need your voices.
The observance of the International Quds Day, established in 1979 by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, has become a global tradition of marches and conferences advocating for the Palestinian cause. His appeal for global solidarity continues to resonate worldwide. Africa is part and parcel of this international movement in support of Palestine. Now, let's start off with Dr. Firoz Osman. How has the International Quds Day contributed to raising awareness about the Palestinian liberation struggle across the African continent?
The Iranian Revolution in 1979 was a true revolution. In other words, many of the other revolutions that have taken place did not remove the institutions and the deep state. For example, what happened in Egypt. You know, it lasted a year and then it was overthrown again. And the old systems and their controllers came back in power. So it is probably in recent memory, the only true revolution. And it is quite remarkable for Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah Alayh, that in 1979, he already declared Al-Quds Day. It showed their determination to free the third most holiest shrine. And it is a day that has been commemorated now ever since 45 years or plus. And it has created a global phenomenon, not only in Africa, as we mentioned, but throughout the world, where Palestine has been brought up into the map. Many others are gaining, given under the current circumstances, what is happening in Gaza, that they are getting courage from what has been happening in Gaza. There is no doubt that, you know, it is Iran that stands against the world system that wants to occupy and oppress people, and it is the Palestinians in Gaza that is fighting the same phenomenon with a great deal of courage, looking to Al-Quds for their liberation, to all countries that are helping them. And in fact, you know, it is the protest marches that began right in Iran in 1979 that continues till this day.
Thanks for that, Dr. Osman. Now let's bring in Hassan Loget. At the 30th African Union Summit held in Addis Ababa last February, African leaders took a strong position against Israel, denouncing its assault on Gaza as genocide and demanding a halt to all cooperation until the Israeli occupation ends. Now, how does Africa's steadfast support for Palestine pose a significant challenge to Netanyahu, who has spent the past decade working to expand Israel's influence across the continent?
The 38th African summit, the AU summit, held in Addis, was very significant because it suggested for the first time that Africa was uniting once again behind Palestine. We have to go back many decades, I think in the early 1980s, when the Organization of African Unity was at its height, trying to create a program for the liberation of the African continent from colonialism and apartheid, that they made a statement in the founding declaration of the African People's Charter, African Charter for Human and People's Rights. And that charter, also known as the Banjul document, was very, very instrumental in putting Zionism as one of the targets. And I wanted to quote a little bit of it. The charter basically said they wanted to achieve the total liberation of Africa, of peoples which are still struggling for their dignity and genuine independence, and undertaking to eliminate colonialism, neocolonialism, apartheid, and Zionism, and to dismantle aggressive foreign military bases and all forms of discrimination, particularly those based on race, ethnic groups, color, sex, language, religion, or political opinion. So it looks like this was a victory for the progressive forces led by South Africa and Algeria.
Ties between the Israeli apartheid regime and the African Union significantly worsened after Israel's assault on Gaza in October 2023. Which led to mass atrocities and genocide, resulting in the deaths of over 50,000 Palestinian women and children. Across Africa, people have gathered in massive numbers for rallies in solidarity with Palestine, especially during International Quds Day. These demonstrations impacted the African Union's policy decisions.
The African Union is pivotal. It is important for increasing pressure on the Zionist entity. If we recall way back in 1973, most African countries, almost all bar one or two, broke their ties after the oil embargo in support of the Palestinians, in support of the Arab world. However, the Zionist entity's aim is to bring about a change in Africa, in the African nation states, through the observer status in the African Union. We know a year or two ago that South Africa played a pivotal role to remove the Zionist entity from its observer status in the African Union, despite the fact that some of the African Union member states wanted Israel to be present. You see, what the Zionist state does is to use its soft power, its technology, its military, where they bribe and blackmail and try to influence the African nation states to support Israel against the Palestinians. And this is where, again, the Iranian Islamic Republic of Iran has played an important role. It is also important for other Muslim nations to be aware of what is happening in parts of Africa, and to help the African nations to ward off the soft power that the Zionist entity is using.
Many African countries are actively forging stronger ties with global powers that challenge Western dominance, such as China, Russia, and Iran. These alliances grant them greater political leverage, enabling them to take more independent stances on international matters, including the Palestinian issue. The evolving geopolitical landscape has played a key role in further isolating Israel's apartheid regime in Africa.
Where you find Israel, you'll find conflict. And I think that the countries that want to turn away from conflict have to find a path of peace and are looking for other ways. In the Sahel region, a number of countries have kicked off the leadership military alliances with France. But as I pointed out earlier, we need to negotiate new terms of engagement and relationships with countries like Russia. And so that we do not find ourselves a few years down the line with someone that we cannot live with. We need to live with countries that will affirm African values so that Africa can use its own minerals for its betterment. And we can't replace one set of dictators for another. So yes, getting France out has been strategic, but Africa must renegotiate its terms of engagement with other countries on its own politics, its own agenda that's African-centric. And Kwame Nkrumah was very, very clear that Africa's got a long way to build a United States of Africa where all our resources could be used to uplift our own people.
The comparison between the Israeli regime policies towards Palestinians and the deposed South African apartheid regime has been made by both scholars and political leaders. Now, Dr. Osman, this is for you. In what ways do you see this parallel playing out today, particularly because Western powers, which once supported the apartheid regime in South Africa, are now backing the Israeli apartheid regime?
South Africa under apartheid is exactly the same as apartheid in Israel. And this is said very clearly by our first president, Nelson Mandela. It was said by our moral voice in South Africa, Bishop Tutu. In fact, they didn't say it's exactly the same. They say what is going on in Israel is worse than what has happened in South Africa. That the apartheid there is worse. And we can see it from the genocide. In fact, the Media Review Network commissioned a book, and it is entitled Why Israel? The Anatomy of Zionist Apartheid, a South African Perspective, where it makes very clear the parallels between what was under apartheid in South Africa and what is apartheid in Israel at the moment. And in fact, it's become so obvious that it is no longer a debatable issue. The reason for the support of Zionist apartheid is that the same countries that supported white apartheid racism in South Africa are supporting the Zionist Israeli state, such as Germany, United States of America, Great Britain, France. All of them supported white South Africa until it became untenable, until they could no longer control it and could not stop it. So these are the same racist, white settler, colonial regimes that are supporting Israel today. And in fact, we can see that what is going on with the Trump administration today, that it is white settler colonialism.
Well, thanks for that, Dr. Osman. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on Africa's solidarity with Palestine as we mark the International Quds Day. Stay with us.
Africa backs Quds liberation.
In late 2023, South Africa filed a case at the International Court of Justice over the Israeli apartheid regime's genocidal war on Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. Ron Lamoda, the current South African foreign minister, speaks here at the ICJ, where he led his country's legal team while serving as the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services. Let's take a listen.
Thank you, Madam President, and distinguished members of the court. It is an honor for me to stand here in front of you on behalf of the Republic of South Africa on this exceptional case. In extending our hands across the miles to the people of Palestine, we do so in full knowledge that we are part of a humanity that is at one. These were the words of our founding president, Nelson Mandela. This is the spirit in which South Africa acceded to the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Crime of Genocide in 1998. This is the spirit in which we approach this court as a contracting party to the Convention. This is a commitment we owe to the people of Palestine and Israelis alike. As previously mentioned, the violence and the destruction in Palestine and Israel did not begin on the 7th of October 2023. The Palestinians have experienced systematic oppression and violence for the last 76 years.
Well, South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice has been described as both a legal and moral stance against the genocide in Gaza. Now, Mr. Logan, this is for you. How significant is this moment for South Africa's history, given its own past with apartheid, and how does it shape its role in global justice and human rights advocacy?
We have to find whatever means possible to preserve a sensible system in the world, a system of equality amongst nations, so that the rule of law, international human rights law, can actually prevail. At present, Trump wants might to rule, not justice, might. And I think South Africa is correct in building these alliances. Our ambassador was declared a persona non grata in America, and Trump has basically asked him to leave the country. This is Ibrahim Rasool, for simply speaking at a web conference in this country, Mistra, where he basically said that Trump and him are fearing the increasing numbers of black and brown peoples in the world, in America, that are beginning to have influence. And he implied that they were trying to preserve white supremacist politics. None of that is untrue, but he's chosen to punish South Africa. So Trump and him are being vindictive, not only to South Africa, but anyone who dared to oppose them, even people in his own party. But South Africa is being bullied. Unfortunately, there are a number of people in our country who actually support Trump, and they happen to be from those who are privileged, happen to be largely white.
Julius Malema, the leader of South Africa's Economic Freedom Fighters Party, frequently takes part in demonstrations backing the Palestinian resistance. In this speech, he expresses his support for Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement. Let's tune in.
What type of a government do we have in Israel that goes and bomb a hospital where people have run away for refugee, where people are sick, where children are there, where pregnant women are there? You bomb a hospital and you say you are looking for Hamas, but you are killing innocent children. There is nothing wrong Hamas did. These folk tongues and people speaking in parables, and we don't know what they are hearing, what they are saying, it's wrong. When you are oppressed, the only option you have is to fight. And that's what Hamas is doing. They are fighting for their freedom. Mandela did the same thing, took up the guns and fought for the freedom of the people of South Africa. When you are oppressed, you only have one option. Confront the enemy and shoot to kill. Do not kiss the enemy.
South Africa's liberation hero, Nelson Mandela, became known and respected all over the world as a symbol of the struggle against apartheid and all forms of racism. He was steadfast in his support for the liberation of Palestine. He famously stated that, "We know too well that our freedom